Good afternoon and good morning to everyone who's on the line. We have over 500 people with us this morning. I'm Alan Paller, Director of Research at the SANS Institute, and I'll be introducing Joshua Wright. Joshua Wright, who will be briefing you on this new WPA-WPA2 break. It is more than a little important, and I think the numbers of people on the line help reinforce the idea of how important it is. If you go to slide 2, you'll learn a little bit more about Josh. You also have his email there. But for this session, just because he's going to be really busy, send your questions to Q, just the letter Q, at sans.org. After the session, you can send them to Josh. But this is a kind of education that SANS does a lot of. We call them SANS at home when we do our courses this way, where you have the live speaker, you can ask questions, you have the slides. Many people feel it's better to take our long courses in the SANS at home because they can take them in their pajamas and still learn. So this will give you a sense of how these SANS at home things really work. But this is part of our keeping you up to date on the most critical new vulnerabilities program. And the speaker is one of SANS' top instructors, the person who authors and edits SANS' wireless ethical hacking course. He's one of the senior instructors, which is something that only a few people in the world have reached. And he's a senior security analyst with InGuardians. But mainly he's known the world over as the top wireless security guy. I remember a talk he gave one evening at Disney World, a hotel in Disney World, and my wife and I were walking around the grounds, and for 2 hours afterwards, every single conversation you could hear would be people repeating what Josh said. So you're in for a treat. Let me go to slide 3 and turn it over to Josh, but do ask questions all along the way, q@sans.org. With that, Josh Wright.
Thank you very much, Alan, and thank you for the very flattering introduction, and thank you to everybody on the call as well today. This is a particularly exciting topic to me. There's been some very interesting, if not disconcerting, research and analysis done on what I believe is a significant vulnerability that affects many, many networks that are deployed the world over. And we're going to spend some time talking about this today and talk about a little bit about what's involved in this attack, just kind of outline the implications of the attack, what the impact is to me, that sort of thing. We'll do some attack analysis as well, and this is where we're going to get much deeper into understanding exactly how these research analysts figured out how to do so much damage against this wireless technology. We'll spend some time after that talking about some enterprise defenses. Okay, now that we understand the vulnerability, Josh, what do we do about it? And I'm going to use some examples that are applicable to almost every network out there with some real vendor configuration recommended changes and configuration advice. At the end, we'll do a quick summary and some question and answer as well. So moving on to the next slide, slide number 4, titled The Bad News. Okay, so here's the bottom line. Two research analysts, Martin Beck from the Technical University of Dresden and Eric Tuge from the Technical University of Darmstadt, they discovered a flaw in the TKIP wireless encryption protocol. TKIP is something called the Temporal Key Integrity Protocol. It's a mechanism that we use in very popular wireless networks to protect all the data that we're transmitting. It's often used in the WPA and the WPA2 protocols, and we'll talk more about that. I was just speaking to Martin by proxy a couple of minutes ago, and it turns out that Martin Beck is actually the author of this vulnerability, and he was actually assisted by Eric Tuge here. Now, the impact of this vulnerability is this. It allows an attacker to decrypt data to a wireless client on a WPA or WPA2 network when TKIP isn't used, albeit very slowly. They can't decrypt a lot of data, but they can decrypt some data, enough data, such that once they have recovered some of this plain text content, now they have an opportunity for further damage. Once they've decrypted some data on the network, then they can take any packet they want and send it into the network to reach that client. Now, there are some limitations on this, and we'll talk about that, but the bottom line is that an attacker can decrypt arbitrarily selected packets, and once he's decrypted a packet, he can inject any packet of his choosing into the network. And all of this is done without any authentication or authorization requirements. Any attacker can pull off this attack as long as it meets a couple of requirements on the infrastructure network that we believe are very common. Moving on to the next slide, slide 5, titled The Good News. Okay. So that is pretty damaging, and that's certainly not a good situation for a lot of people to be in right now. However, there are some good points that we should point out as well. This is not a key recovery attack. So while this attack is fairly damaging, it's not on the same level as a web attack, where it's possible for the attacker to fully recover the web key, decrypt all the data, inject whatever he wants into the network, and just have full reign over everything that's happening. It's not quite that bad. It does allow an attacker to decrypt data, but it does not allow them to then later decrypt other arbitrary frames without repeating the same procedure. Another good point is that it does not affect the networks that are using the AES-CCMP protocol. AES, of course, is the Advanced Encryption Standard, and CCMP is an acronym that makes you hate acronyms. It stands for cipher block chaining. this is one of those acronyms that I hate because I always forget what this acronym means. Cipher block chaining, counter mode message authenticity check protocol. It's a terribly long acronym name, but it's basically the protocol that we use in wireless networks to apply AES encryption to our data. And if you're working with or a member of the United States Department of Defense and you're complying with the DoD requirements for wireless networks, you are probably not going to be vulnerable to this particular attack because those Department of Defense policies require that you use this AES cipher instead. We'll talk more about that towards the end of the presentation. Some more good news is that there are some workarounds we can use. They're not perfect, and quite honestly, I'm a little concerned about them because they've not been exhaustively tested yet, and we don't really understand the implications of making these changes. However, I think we will very shortly find out what those implications are. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 6, who is affected? Okay. So now at this point, we've talked about what the good news is, we talked about what the bad news is. Are you vulnerable? Should certainly be the next question on your mind. So who is affected by this vulnerability? Well, any deployment that's using the TKIP protocol, that's that temporal key integrity protocol, is vulnerable. I've heard a lot of references in the press saying this is an attack against the WPA. While it is an attack against WPA, just because you're using WPA2 does not mean that you are protected. Both WPA and WPA2 are vulnerable when used with the TKIP protocol. Now, with WPA2, you could use that AES-based CCMP cipher. However, many organizations still continue to use the TKIP cipher with those WPA2 networks. Now, this attack does not change in any way if you use pre-shared key authentication or 802.1x authentication using an EAP type like PEEP or EAP TLS. So this vulnerability will affect networks regardless of the authentication mechanism you're using. Right now, the exploits, and exploits is italicized there because it's not a limitation of the vulnerability, but it's a limitation of the tools that exploit this particular vulnerability. Right now, those exploits are only targeting the TKIP protocol when used with quality of service settings. Quality of service is something that was introduced in the IEEE specification 802.11e. Many organizations have it turned on by default on a lot of their hardware, and a lot of modern clients support QoS as well. Very, very common to see, especially in 802.11n networks as well. In fact, QoS is required for much of 802.11n. So just to recap, just so everybody's clear, am I affected or not? You are affected if you're running TKIP, and you're vulnerable to the exploit if you use QoS on your network. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 7, called Attacker Opportunity. So what is the attacker's opportunity here? Well, he can do a couple of things. The attacker can decrypt a packet coming from the access point to a station not more than 1 byte per minute. Okay? Now, that doesn't seem too bad when you think about it at first. 1 byte per minute, well, to decrypt a 200-byte packet is going to take over 3 hours? Yes, it will. However, there's been some very interesting adaptation for this work that can actually decrypt with known plain text in packets, and we'll get to how that works in just a couple of minutes. Right now, there is no limitation for the attacker into what packet they select. So the attacker can pick something that looks like, for example, an ARP packet, which we'll talk about in a second, or they could pick any other packet. When they pick a different type of a packet, again, they can only decrypt 1 byte per minute, so they might not be able to get through the entire packet to decrypt all of the contents, but they'll be able to extract some information out of it. And sometimes, some information could be the very vulnerable secrets that you don't want disclosed. Right now, the current attacks that we're looking at that seem to be the most effective are those targeting the ARP protocol. That's that address resolution protocol that we use at layer 2. Now, with an ARP packet, an attacker knows a lot of that packet contents. An ARP request packet is 68 bytes in length, and most of that 68 bytes is known to the attacker because it's always the same every time the packet is transmitted. What is not known to the attacker is between 14 and 17 bytes of data. So we're talking about a 68-byte encrypted packet. The attacker knows or can deduce several parts of that packet's content. What it can't figure out is between 14 and 17 bytes of that data, and that breaks down into an 8-byte, what we call message integrity check, a 4-byte integrity check value, and between 2 and 5 bytes of the IP source in the IP destination of that ARP request packet. Now, once the attacker has all of this packet, this encrypted packet content, and he's deduced a good portion of it, now he only has to try to recover between those 14 and 17 bytes. Okay? So between 14 and 17 bytes is the only thing the attacker needs to decrypt. Now, when we return to that concept of not more than 1 byte per minute, now this gets very interesting, because now the attacker can get the entire frame's plain text content between 14 and 17 minutes of time. Okay? So now that becomes very interesting, and we'll see how we can apply that later on in the presentation. Now, the important point, and what I really want you to take away from this slide, is that last bullet there with a big red arrow. Once the attacker knows all 68 bytes of plain text of that ARP packet, now they can really do some damage. Once they have that information, now they can take arbitrary packets that they pick, packets that the attacker crafts to do various things. Now, with those packets, he can inject them into the network to target clients. And this has some very interesting opportunities for the attacker to manipulate the network. One of them is ARP poisoning. If an attacker can inject any packet into the network, well, why not inject an ARP packet that messes up how the network is processing and bridging traffic? Or maybe the attacker can insert some DNS frames that are malformed to attack client implementations or to attack different DNS caching mechanisms. The attacker can also inject something like a TCP SYN request. Remember earlier in the presentation I said, once that attacker can decrypt that one frame, he can't decrypt later frames without repeating the same procedure. Well, if I inject a TCP SYN request as an attacker, I can't observe the SYNAC on the wireless side, but we'll look at some examples of how that can still be useful later on. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 8, the outline slide. So we spent some time talking about what is the outline of this attack. Just to summarize that, this vulnerability affects TKIP, whether you use it in WPA or WPA2 networks. It is applicable regardless of the authentication mechanism, either pre-shared key or an 802.1x authentication mechanism. And the current exploit tools are targeting QoS networks. Okay? What an attacker can do is decrypt not more than 1 byte per minute, and once he's decrypted a packet, he can inject arbitrary packets into the wireless network as well. That pretty much summarizes our attack overview. What I wanted to do was to give you a better idea of really what's happening here behind the scenes. Okay? So we're going to spend the next several slides in the attack analysis section looking at how this attack works. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 9, titled April 2003. So let's turn back in time a little bit. Let's get a little perspective on what happens here. TGIF was a protocol that was introduced in April 2003 to fix the WEP protocol. So in April 2003, TGIF came out because we knew WEP was badly broken, and we needed a protocol that we could use on our existing WEP equipment while people bought equipment to transition into that WPA2 AES CCMP cipher. One of the vulnerabilities with WEP was that there was no replay attack protection. So on the top half of this slide, on the far left, we've got our victim. On the bottom, the guy with the evil black hat, that's our attacker. And on the right, the triangle with the little dot and the lines coming off of it, that's our access point. The packets in the middle are, the rectangles in the middle are packets that are being transmitted. So let's say on the top half of the slide, this is a WEP network. In a WEP network, the AP can transmit a WEP encrypted packet onto the network, and that's the green valid packet all the way to the left. When an attacker sniffs that packet, he can then replay it into the network simply by retransmitting it. He doesn't modify it. He just retransmits that packet back into the network. The AP on the far right thinks every one of those packets are valid, not only the first packet, the green packet, but each of the replays from the attacker as well. This is a significant problem for WEP that's been used for many different types of attacks. So if we move to the bottom half of the slide, we start looking at how the TKIP protocol attempted to fix this issue. With TKIP, it introduced something called a TKIP sequence counter, or a TSC. The TSC is a 16-bit number from 0 to 65,535, and every time a station or an AP transmits a packet, they increment that TSC by 1. After 65,535 packets, both the AP and the client have to rekey. They have to rotate keys again so that they're always using a fresh key to encrypt and decrypt data. The TSC value is also used to prevent these replay attacks. So on the far left, we've got the TKIP sequence counter number 38. If you look at the AP all the way on the right, he has the TSC 38, and he says, okay. Next comes TSC 40 from the client to the access point. What the receiving station has to do is he has to make sure that the TSC is at least one greater than the last packet. Okay? It doesn't have to be the next sequential value. Notice that 39 is missing here. It just has to be at least one greater. Okay? So in this case, with the AP says TSC 40, okay, is that greater than 38? It is, so I'm going to accept that packet. If the attacker sniffed TSC 40 and tried to replay into the network as if it were a WEP network, the receiving station would say, is TSC 40 greater than TSC 40? Well, no, of course it's not, so I'm going to drop that packet. This allows, this prevents an attacker from taking an arbitrary packet and replaying into the network, and it was a significant improvement over what's been done in WEP networks. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 10. So this is terrific. You know, we've defeated replay attacks in TKIP. That's terrific. That's significantly better than WEP until July 2005. Okay? So July 2005 comes around, and the 802.11e specification for quality of service is introduced with a protocol known as wireless multimedia. When you think about QoS, it's basically a way for a transmitter to reorder the delivery of packets. I've got a data packet, but right afterwards I have a voice packet. You know, I should really transmit that voice packet before I transmit my data packet, and that's effectively going to be putting them out of order. Now, out of order packet transmissions are a significant problem for the TKIP sequence enforcement mechanism. So, how did we solve this in the 802.11e committee? So what 802.11e said is, hey, we'll maintain multiple independent unsynchronized sequence counters. So now if you look all the way on the right of that illustration on the bottom, instead of enforcing TKIP sequence counter values on a sequential basis, now the receiving station breaks up into multiple queues. We enforce sequence number validation, but we give it some flexibility among different queues. So here's an example. If you look on the left, we've got data packet TSC38, and then we've got a voice packet TSC39, and now a data packet TSC40. And now we've got another data packet, TSC41. Oh, but wait, we're going to transmit this voice packet first. That's TSC42. So TSC42 goes out first. Now, when the AP receives TSC42, he says, well, is it greater than the last one I saw? And the last one I saw on the voice queue was 39. So, yep, TSC42 is okay. Now, when packet 41 finally gets delivered to the access point, the access point checks it against the last data packet that it saw. The last data packet that it saw was TSC 40. So 41 is greater than 40, so terrific. I'll accept that packet as well. Now, this allowed us to do QoS on a wireless network, which really was an important mechanism, and we needed this for things like voice over IP. However, it certainly complicated matters. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 11. So I think a lot of you out there are probably going, wait, what, really? They did that? And the answer is yes, they really did. Now, what wireless multimedia did was it displaced sequence enforcement across multiple queues. This is a significant security failure. And quite honestly, it should never have been allowed to have happened. I actually identified this problem. I reported it to the author of the wireless multimedia specification late 2004, and the author of WMM chose not to do anything about it. It's a sad story. I don't have time to get into it now. It was an important lesson for me, but basically they were told about this issue, and they chose not to fix it. So unfortunately, now this issue is going to bite us again. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 12, titled 802.11e replay attack. So what is the implication of this issue, this failure in QoS on a TKIP network? Well, effectively what this allows an attacker to do is to capture traffic from one queue and then to play it again on another queue. When the attacker plays it again on another queue, the TKIP sequence counter is only validated based off that queue that's being attacked. So in this example here, we've got a couple of steps. We've got steps in the little white boxes there with the numbers inside them. So if we look on the far left, we've got our four queues, voice, video, best effort, and background. And if we look at step one, the legitimate station on the left is transmitting a packet with TSC22. That gets sent all the way over to the access point, and the access point says, okay, background queue, the last value I saw was 222, all set. Now, we have another packet being transmitted in step three there, the video queue, 223, which updates the video TKIP sequence counter to 223. The attacker sniffs packet 223 from the video queue and then retransmits it on the background queue. Is 223 going to be accepted on this other queue? Yes, it is, because the last TSC that we saw on the background queue was 222. This gives the attacker to now manipulate the network and replay data. Now, this is interesting, but there's another implication here. When the attacker takes a packet, manipulates it, and transmits it on a different queue number, it actually changes some of the attributes of the packet, and it makes the message integrity check fail. Now, there's a special rule in 802.11 networks that use this TKIP protocol. When two packets are received within 60 seconds where the message integrity check fails, the AP or the client is to completely shut down all communications, disconnect everybody that they're talking to, and then to go in a silent and dormant state for 60 seconds. This is something known as Michael countermeasures. And while it sounds bad, it was a necessary component to mitigate some of the other issues with this protocol.
Josh, can I interrupt for just a second?
Certainly, Alan.
We're getting great questions. And the only reason I haven't interrupted you to ask them is that I think you're getting some of the answers are coming out later in the session. But please keep the questions coming. We'll cover them as soon as we're done with the slides. So thank you to everyone who sent questions in. Go ahead, Josh.
Oh, terrific, Alan. Thank you very much. And thank you to everybody for pouring all those questions in, too. And certainly, I'll do my best to answer them all in the time we have allotted or afterwards by email. So moving on to the next slide, slide number 13, the web ICV attack called ChopChop. We know about the QoS vulnerability. That's one part of this issue. But let's also talk about a vulnerability in web networks that we know to be the ChopChop attack. With web networks, the only thing that made a packet valid or invalid is something called the integrity check value, the ICV. The ICV is just a 32-bit checksum. Now, 32-bit checksum, not so strong from a hashing perspective. It's not something like a SHA-512 hash or a RIPE-MD-160 hash. No, no. This is CRC-32, a very weak hashing algorithm, but also very fast, which is important for the implementation of the web protocol and was actually carried over into TKIP networks. The ChopChop attack basically works like this. In step one here with a little white box, the attacker observes an arbitrary packet. Let's say it's 200 bytes going from the client to the access point. The attacker takes that packet and removes the last byte of the payload. Now, that's going to make that ICV invalid now. However, some interesting mathematical algorithms tell us that there's only one value between 0 and 255 that will make that ICV valid again. So now what the attacker does is he removes that byte. He then tries to fix the ICV, and then he sends that packet with his guess to the access point or to the station. And he waits to see if the access point sends a response. He repeats this procedure with a guess of 0, a guess of 1, a guess of 2, a guess of 3, all the way up to 254, until eventually one of his guesses will be successful. Now, the guessed value actually reveals the plain text of the byte the attacker chopped out. That 200th byte that we talked about that he removed, now the attacker knows one byte of plain text. Well, now the attacker just repeats that procedure. Now he's got a valid 199-byte packet, and he repeats, and he chops it to 198, and he does it again and again and again. Now, depending on the speed of the network, the connectivity the attacker has, this can actually be fairly rapid, where I've been able to decrypt, let's say, a 68-byte ARP packet, which has a lot of zeros in it, in less than 10 seconds. As a rule of thumb. You can decrypt longer data as well, but it does give the attacker the ability, without knowing the key on the network, to decrypt the traffic. I like to refer to this as the attacker using the access point as a special decoder ring. The AP is basically revealing the plain text contents of a selected packet one byte at a time by manipulating how the AP is receiving data. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 14. So that's another web flaw. How is this fixed, in TKIP? TKIP adds a new per-packet hashing algorithm, or a MIC, known as Michael. Michael is an algorithm that generates this 64-bit hash on each packet that's transmitted on a TKIP network. Now, this is a weak algorithm, and it was one of the major barriers in the design of the TKIP protocol as part of the wireless security standard. However, it was the best that we could do on this legacy web hardware that we had to deal with. As a result, Michael has this thing that we call Michael countermeasures. We talked about it a little bit a minute ago. Basically, with Michael countermeasures, when the AP receives two packets with an invalid MIC, within 60 seconds, the AP is to disconnect all users and go completely silent, radio silence, for another 60 seconds. Once that 60 seconds is done, he comes back up online, he rekeys all the users, and now they can continue operating. This is kind of a built-in denial of service attack vulnerability in TKIP. It's existed for a while. It has not been widely exploited. However, I think that's probably going to change in the near future. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 15, TKIP encryption and decryption. Okay. So we've got a little background. We know that the QoS issue introduced some problems with TKIP networks. We also know about that ChopChop attack issue, and we know that the Michael algorithm is used to validate or invalidate the use of a packet on the network. This slide is fairly complicated. I'm not going to go over all of the contents here, but basically it's a graphical illustration of how you encrypt a packet on the left, starting with plain text, all the way to the bottom of the slide where you've got your TCP sequence counter plus your encrypted packet, and the encrypted packet contains the plain text contents, that 64-bit Michael MIC, and the 32-bit ICV. Now, that gets transmitted over the wireless network, which, as we know, an attacker can observe that wireless transmission. What happens on the other side? That's where it gets interesting for us and where we're going to get into this attack. When you receive a packet as a station, you get that TSC, and you get the encrypted packet contents. Well, the first thing you do is you check that TSC. Is that TCP sequence counter greater than the last one I saw for the queue that it arrived on? If it isn't, then I'm going to drop that packet, and then I'm going to continue on my very business. If it is valid, though, then I'm going to calculate my encryption key, then I'm going to decrypt the data, and now I'm going to do a couple of interesting things. I'm going to check that 32-bit CRC, that ICV, first. If that ICV is valid, I'm going to accept the packet, and I'm going to move on to another step. But if it's not valid, I'm going to drop the packet. Let's say that ICV is valid, and then I'm going to check that Michael hash, another hash check step there. If the Michael hash is not valid, then I'm going to send back an error to the access point. I'm going to tell the access point in an encrypted packet, hey, this packet was not valid. I want you to know, because if you see another of these, you have to enable Michael countermeasures. Okay? So the client has to tell the AP that he receives an invalid Michael packet. If the packet has a valid MIC hash, well, then I process the packet and I send it into upstream protocols. Moving on to the next slide, slide 16, and this is exploited. How? All right. So now we've gone through a lot of this background information, and I think, as you can see, this is a fairly technical attack and has a lot of interesting components to it. So how does the attacker use all of these conditions to exploit a TCP network? Well, we saw in the last slide that if the ICV fails, the AP or the client generates no attack activity, no message is sent. I just simply drop the packet and I move on with my packet processing duties. However, if the MIC causes a failure, that Michael hash, if that causes a failure, then the client has to send a packet to the access point that says, wait a minute, I got an invalid MIC, prepare for countermeasures if the AP sees another one of these invalid MICs within 60 seconds. Now, this is very interesting because it allows the attacker to use kind of a stimulus and response mechanism, okay? So if the attacker observes that MIC failure, and that packet, like I said, is encrypted, but it's unique enough where even though it's encrypted, the attacker can determine when it's being transmitted. If he sees a MIC failure, he knows that the ICV passed, because if the ICV failed, the packet would have been silently dropped. So here's how the attack works. The attacker takes a packet coming from the access point to a client. He removes the last byte of data. That's going to make both the ICV and the MIC invalid. He takes that packet and he transmits it onto a different QoS queue. Because it's on a different QoS queue, the TCP sequence enforcement is no longer in play. TCP sequence number is fine because of that QoS vulnerability we talked about earlier. Now, the attacker tries to fix that broken ICV, and if the ICV is not fixed, meaning it's one of the values where the ICV was not corrected, then the client simply drops the packet. However, what if the attacker did guess the right ICV? What's going to happen then? Well, when the attacker got the right ICV, then the client is going to send the Michael MIC failure message. That tells the attacker that he guessed right to fix the ICV, which reveals one byte of plain text. Now, the attacker knows one byte of plain text. He can continue to do the chop-chop attack, just like we did on our web network, with one caveat. He has to wait 60 seconds before he can make another guess. Because if he makes another guess and gets another MIC failure message, then the AP is going to disconnect all users and go through the rekey process. And once the client has gone through a rekey process, the attacker has to start over again. So the attacker waits 60 seconds, and then he repeats. After 60 seconds, he can withstand one MIC failure, as long as he doesn't trigger two. Moving on to the next slide, slide 17, titled the TKIP-CHOP-CHOP ICV attack. Now, I have unfortunately not seen the slides from Martin and Eric yet that talked about this particular attack vulnerability. However, my understanding and my analysis of the source code they've released, the attack works like this. So we've got five steps here, just to illustrate. In step one, the attacker captures a packet coming from the client to the access point. This is on a TKIP network. In step two, the attacker removes the last byte of payload, making that 68-byte ARP packet a 67-byte encrypted ARP packet. Okay? He tries to guess how to fix that ICV, and he sends it back to the client. In step three, the client's going to look at the packet he receives from the attacker, go through the calculation process, and say, wait a minute, this has got a bad ICV. I'm going to drop it. But this is another bad ICV. Drop that, too. Another bad ICV. Drop that, too. Oh, this ICV passed. Oh, but MIC failed. And then he's going to send, in step four, a MIC failure message to the access point. When the attacker observes that MIC failure message, he can now deduce that recovered plain text byte from the victim's packet, from that selected packet. He waits 60 seconds so as not to trigger Michael countermeasures, and then he repeats the process with the 67-byte packet. And he does it again and again and again until he's recovered all the contents of that packet. Okay, moving on to the next slide, slide number 18, attack results. So just to recap here, what is the result of this attack? The attacker can decrypt not more than one byte per minute. He can't decrypt more than that, otherwise he'll trigger Michael countermeasures. The ARP packet that we talked about is mostly plain text. The ARP packet itself is almost all known plain text. The only thing that's really not known are the source address and the destination address, the IP addresses. However, if the attacker knows that the class C or whatever the network is he's attacking is, for example, 192.168.1.something, well, then there's only two bytes he doesn't know, the last octet. In this case, he knows A, B, and C. He doesn't know Y or Z. Okay? Even if he has to figure out the first three bytes of the IP address, he doesn't have to do it twice because ARP is a layer 2 protocol. If he figures it out for one, he'll know it for the other as well. So the attacker really, in a worst-case scenario, only has to recover 5 bytes of that ARP packet. Now, there's also some more data in the packet the attacker has to recover. He has to recover that ICV value, that 4-byte value. He also has to recover the MIC value as well. So total, it's between 14 and 17 bytes of unknown data that the attacker has to recover. Once he's recovered between 14 and 17 bytes, the rest of that ARP packet is known plain text. Now, he has 68 bytes of known plain text ciphertext pair. And this is where it gets really interesting on the next slide titled Another Michael Weakness, slide number 19. So the Michael protocol is invertible, which means that if you have the hash and you have the plain text contents that produce the hash, you can invert them and recover the Michael key out of the situation as well. So once the attacker has found all of the plain text contents of that ARP packet and he's recovered that 8-byte MIC, now he knows the entire contents of the Michael key. With the Michael key, now the attacker can do some very interesting things. With the Michael key, the attacker can take the decrypted contents, encrypt a new packet of his own choosing, make it valid with the ICV and the Michael hash, and then transmit it into the network. Now, the attacker cannot send an infinite number of these injected packets into the network because of TKIP sequence enforcement. To the best of our knowledge, on most implementations of client drivers, he will at best be able to inject packets 7 times. After 7 packets, he has to reproduce this whole procedure to be able to inject another 7 packets. On some client drivers, we believe that the issue is that the attacker can inject up to 15 packets, depending on how some of the QoS bits are interpreted in the 802.11e header. And in one implementation that affects Linux systems, I'm told you can inject up to 31 packets or possibly 32 packets. So in most implementations, from my perspective, this tells me that the attacker can inject between 7 and 15 packets into the network. That can be very damaging. That can have a significant effect on the security of the network, as we'll see in the next slide, slide number 20, titled Practical TKIP Attack Example. So here's an example of an attack. On the bottom of the slide, we've got our attacker. Our attacker uses this whole TKIP attack magic to decrypt that ARP packet. Now, once he's decrypted that ARP packet, he can inject, let's say, 7 arbitrary packets to a victim client. One choice of packets the attacker might use to inject is a TCP SYN request. So in step one, the attacker decrypts an ARP packet and injects a TCP SYN request to the client. In step two, the client takes that TCP SYN request and then it appears perfectly valid to him. He responds to it. He's going to respond with a SYN ACK if it's an open port, or a reset ACK if it's to a closed port. Where's the response going to go? Well, in step one, when the attacker injected the packet, he used a public IP address as the source. So that public IP address is probably an agent the attacker has control of, all the way on the right of the slide in step three. When that agent receives those decrypted packets, those packets that have been injected and then responded to from the victim client, the attacker can then do a couple of interesting things. He can port scan a machine, 7 to 15 ports at a time, kind of slowly, or he might even be able to complete the TCP three-way handshake with the victim client. So that's pretty significant to me, because even though the network is protected by TKIP, it looks like what an attacker could do is launch exploits against a system inside of the network by initiating the connection through this TKIP vulnerability. Other opportunities, like we talked about, DNS manipulation, or ARP manipulation on the LAN, or UDP-based buffer overflow exploits. The Witty Worm was probably my one of the classic examples of UDP-based exploit mechanisms. The Witty Worm was vulnerable was an issue with a vulnerability in the real ICE, the Black ICE firewall, where a single UDP packet would exploit that firewall and cause the system to be compromised. Well, if there were UDP-based exploits the attacker can select, he can inject them into the TKIP network, compromise a client, and not need any response to complete that attack. Moving on to the next slide, slide 21, titled TKIP TonNG. So TKIP TonNG is the tool that has been introduced into the AirCrackNG project. So AirCrackNG is a collection of many different attack tools, primarily against web networks, but also against WPA PSK networks and against some Windows systems as well, and has a lot of very interesting functionality. Aircrack-ng.org is the website where you can find all this information. They have included a tool in the not yet released but available in their source code repository that attempts to implement this vulnerability. Now, today, that tool does not work. However, we expect it to be working very shortly, and then attackers will be able to take advantage of this TKIP vulnerability. Moving on to the next slide, slide 22, MKDOS attacks easy now. Another implication of this attack is that now it is publicly made aware, and it's very easy for an attacker to manipulate packets across QoS queues and to trigger Michael countermeasures on any access point or on any client system for that matter. What does this mean? Anybody can come up to your TKIP network if you're using QoS, and can shut down the network for 60 seconds at a time with two packets. Okay? Now, a lot of devices, including on the bottom here, here's an example from a Cisco Autonomous or a Cisco FAT access point. A lot of access points will generate a logging message when they enter Michael Countermeasures mode. In this case, it says, TKIP Michael MIC failure was detected. You want to keep an eye out for those messages, and I'll give you a lot more examples of what to keep an eye out as we go through this presentation. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 23, Enterprise Defenses. So that is a lot of the technical detail behind how this attack actually works. I've got some additional references I'll show you in the end of this presentation, but what I wanted to leave you with are some recommendations on how to defend against this particular attack, and that'll be our next section. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 24, Defense Strategies 1. So, okay, Josh, you've convinced me that this is a problem, and we need to do something about that because we don't want people injecting packets to the network, decrypting content, and manipulating clients through our wireless environment. What do we do? Okay. Well, the best recommendation and the one true fix for this issue is to stop using the TKIP protocol. When TKIP was introduced way back in 2003, it was meant to have a 5-year life cycle. We're about 5 years and 6 months beyond that 5-year life cycle. So really, organizations need to stop using TKIP and move to AES CCNP. For most of you out there, you're probably saying to yourself, that's a great recommendation, Josh. Thanks a lot. Would have done it if I could have. And I recognize that. A lot of people know they should be running the WPA2 CCNP cipher, but aren't because maybe their APs don't support it or they have some legacy clients that don't support it. Okay. So this is definitely the preferred recommendation. However, you need to make sure all of your hardware and all your technology can support this improved cipher. Moving on to slide number 25, Defense Strategies 2. If you have to stay with TKIP, one of the recommendations from the authors of this attack, and I also recommend this practice, is to enable key rotation. So right now with TKIP, you rotate keys every 65,000 packets. Well, how long does that mean in terms of minutes or seconds? Well, and the question is, and the answer is rather, it depends on how busy your clients are. If your clients are not particularly busy, you could stay with that single key for a very long time. I mean, conceivably, an hour over a lunch break without a lot of client from the, without a lot of activity from the client is very reasonable. So, what we're recommending is that users configure their access points to force key rotation earlier. The rule of thumb here is you don't want to rotate keys too frequently because it will put extra load on the APN on clients, but you don't want to do it too infrequently because you're stuck with this vulnerability in TKIP. The rule is that for every minute you use the key, you're exposing 1 byte of plain text data. So if you implement a 4-minute key rotation cycle, every time you rotate a key represents an attacker's ability to gather 4 bytes of data. Now, 4 bytes of data, okay, that's a value I can live with. Maybe even 8 bytes of data is okay with you. I probably wouldn't recommend any more. I think 10 would probably be the limit of what I would recommend for a key rotation schedule. Now, this is an interesting recommendation. However, it has not been tested significantly across lots of devices. Key rotation is a normal thing in a TKIP network. However, we don't know the or quite understand the implications of how all the client devices are going to react to forcing them to rotate keys faster than what they normally would. So this is something that, before deploying in a production network, should really be something that you very carefully test. Now, on the next slide, slide number 26, product-specific steps, over the last week, I've had the pleasure of working with several very responsible and very reactive vendors. I went out and spoke to people at Aruba Networks, Trapeze Networks, Motorola Symbol, BlueSocket, Aerohive Networks, and Cisco as well. Basically, I reached out to every access point vendor that I knew of, and I said, hey, here's the problem. here's a copy of my slides. Please tell me how your products can rotate keys. And I've included the steps on how to do that here in this presentation. I'm not going to go into all the details and how this works, but hopefully your product is listed here and it provides some information for you. One point I want to point out is that with both Cisco Autonomous and Cisco WLC networks, neither of those products support the ability to rotate the keys that you use to encrypt and decrypt traffic. From talking to Cisco, the only thing they could support was actually doing a full re-authentication, which involves your radio server and your client systems going down for a short time while they rekey. When you're doing the encryption-decryption rekey process, you don't have to bring your client down to rekey. However, Cisco does not support that mechanism, unfortunately. So before Cisco users implement those features described there, you definitely want to test them very carefully. Unfortunately, much to my disappointment, Meru Networks did not respond to multiple requests for information, and I'm sorry I was not able to provide any information on how to protect Meru product users. Moving on to the next slide, slide 27, defense strategies. So another defense strategy that's been recommended in some circles is to disable quality of service, because that's used to target the current exploits that are out there. Disabling QoS will probably mitigate any practical attack against your network. However, it does not completely solve the vulnerability. Disabling QoS will prevent tkip-ton-ng from being effective against your network. Again, does not solve the vulnerability altogether. And if you're using technology like 802.11n high throughput, it relies on QoS. And in those cases, you can't turn it off. Another recommendation, some client vendors, I'm hoping that they start taking the lead here, may change how their clients behave and will hopefully produce new drivers that have TKIP implementations that are not vulnerable to this attack. There are several things TKIP driver vendors could do to mitigate the effects of this attack, and I'm hoping that they start adopting some of the strategies, and I'm going to be publishing a paper on my website shortly that provides some strategies for vendors on how to deal with this particular attack. So if you have a lot of software client drivers out there, you probably want to keep an eye on the update driver pages to look for new product releases that attempt to solve this vulnerability. Another recommendation is to enable monitoring. Monitoring will identify when you are under attack. So if you have a WID system, what you need to do, and in my request to everybody on the call, if you have a WID system today, please send an email to your SE or your support organization and ask them, when will you detect this TKIP ICV attack? And really prompt them to add signatures to identify what's going on in this particular case. Now, when they say they can detect it, well, then after that, you can use the tool like tkip-ton-ng to determine if they really can detect it or not. Another option is to turn log monitoring on your access points. What I've done here on this slide and on the next slide, slide number 29, I've included logging messages from almost every vendor. Unfortunately, again, Meru did not respond to any requests for information, but every other vendor did, and I'm very happy that all the vendors provide me information. Now that you know what you will expect from the AP when you're under attack, you will be better prepared to identify those attacks. And all the different products that are listed here have a way to identify when these mixed failures are detected. All right, moving on to the next slide, outline on slide number 30. Now we're going to move on to our summary and Q&A section, moving on to the next slide, 31, titled Summary. So in this short webcast, we spent some time talking about this TKIP vulnerability. This is a break in TKIP. It is definitely a vulnerability in the TKIP protocol, which affects both the WPA and WPA2 networks, again, regardless of the authentication method that you're using. In order to be practically exploited today, you need to have QoS enabled on your network as well. However, that is, if you disable QoS, it is not a solution for the vulnerability. It will just mitigate today's attack tools. Some immediate actions: start planning a transition to that WPA2 CCMP cipher using AES for encryption. Investigate, using the information provided in this presentation, how to implement TKIP key rotation every 2 minutes. Okay? Start with that. If your clients don't respond favorably, then you can try to extend it a little bit more. And finally, capture and analyze the logging data from all the access points in your organization so you can identify when you are a victim of this particular attack. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 32. I want to do some question and answer. I wanted to thank everybody for their time on the presentation today. I have some information here, and if you want to get a copy of these slides in a PDF form later on, I'll probably have that posted by tomorrow morning. You can go to my website at the bottom, willhackforsushi.com. Alan, I would love to take what I'm sure is a queue of pent-up questions.
Yep, there are different kinds of questions. One set is, are my systems vulnerable? One is sort of how it all works. One of them sounds like he's trying to use it to exploit something, and he wants some details. I'm not sure I'll ask you that one. And then there are a couple others. But let me do this one. Mark asks, just to clarify, even if Radius and PEAP and or MS Chat version 2 is used in the wireless LAN environment, the wireless LAN is still vulnerable to exploit if TKIP encryption is used, correct?
And that is correct, Alan, and a very good question. This is not a consumer-level wireless attack. This is not a dictionary attack against the pre-shared key selection process. If you're running PEAP, EAP TLS, MSChat v2, any of the EAP types with TKIP, then you are vulnerable here. Okay, and I would also add, if you're a consumer and you're running TKIP at home with a pre-shared key network, you are also vulnerable. However, I think that your risk is probably diminished because most home users don't have a lot of value for an attacker to go through this much effort to be able to compromise your network.
And 802.11n networks, are they vulnerable? How does this affect them?
So 802.11n is a very interesting case. The 802.11n specification mandates the use of that CCMP cipher. So presumably the intention of the 802.11n working group is that you could only deploy .11n if you used that stronger encryption protocol, CCMP. However, multiple vendors, including Cisco and Aruba Networks, and I'm confident several others, will allow you to do TKIP on your .11n network. And that's primarily to support some of the backward-compatible clients that, even though they aren't doing high throughput, they'll need to be able to connect and communicate on the network.
So yes, the PR tells you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so I was just going to say your .11n network is vulnerable if you use TKIP.
And you probably don't know if you're using it?
Well, if you can determine if you're using it by looking at the configuration of a client system, and it will say TKIP or CCMP or AES. Or you could look at the access point configuration, and that will determine what cipher suite you're using as well.
AES, does AES run on WPA as it does on WPA2?
Great question. WPA does not specify the use of AES. However, there are some non-standard implementations of WPA and AES. WPA plus AES, not vulnerable. Only the use of TKIP is vulnerable.
And as long as we're kind of dealing with this conversion or allowing people to run in non-CCMP mode, this question is it possible for an attacker to downgrade an AES CCMP session to allow TKIP as well? Meaning, can the attacker do that, or does this depend on the AP whether the attacker can or not?
It's a very good question. I would say that it would be unlikely an attacker could do that without exploiting additional deficiencies in wireless technology.
So they'd have to have another way in.
Yeah, if somebody hired me to do it, I think that by having a rogue Radius server in the mix, you could attempt that mechanism. However, the client would play a big piece. I would say specifically, Windows XP clients would most likely fall for some kind of a contrived attack there, but Vista clients would not. Vista significantly improved their wireless stack. So, I would say the answer is not likely, although it's possible.
Okay. Tim asks, where is the, this is just a trivia question, but an important one. Where is the queue number in the packet? It isn't encrypted, he asks?
No, that's a great question. The queue number is not encrypted. If you take a look at an 802.11 packet, the first 24 bytes is always standard and well-defined. And when you add QoS to the network, the next 8 bytes, 2 bytes of which reveal the QoS queue number, and it's not encrypted. Remember when we looked at the TKIP decryption process, we have to validate the TSC first before we decrypt the packet. So to validate the TSC, we need to have that in plain text data and also what queue the TSC was transmitted on to further validate it. So unfortunately, that cannot be encrypted.
Gotcha. This one's one I think you covered pretty well, but I think all of us who aren't experts had some difficulty understanding it. So let me go ahead and ask if Philip asks, why is replaying an unmodified packet a threat? It just seems natural that you would have to modify the packet in order for it to be a real threat.
It's a good example, a very good question, I should say. Why is a replayed unmodified packet a threat? Well, in a web network, one way to generate a tremendous amount of activity on the network, which aids in recovering the key, is to replay an ARP request. What's going to happen when the attacker replays an ARP request? Well, they're going to elicit another ARP response. But what happens if I do that, 500 times a minute? Well, then I'm going to get a lot of ARP requests every minute, and that aids in the attacker's collection of data. If the traffic is encrypted, the attacker may not know what the contents are. ARP packets are of a peculiar frame size and always to the broadcast destination, so they're an exception. But in maybe a contrived example, if you're doing a salary update for somebody and then you revert it, if I replay that update message, then if you didn't apply the revert afterwards, then the original update will still take effect.
This is one for, all right, now you got our attention. Comes from Scott. He says, do you have any suggestions for isolating a test wireless LAN to avoid impacting production wireless LANs?
So it's an interesting question. I keep meaning to write the article, How to Build a Faraday Cage. I used to deal with lots of high-powered stuff, but then I figured, I've already had my kids, so I'm not really too worried about that. but anyway, so, you could build a Faraday cage, really just, getting a lab, preferably in a basement or somewhere where there's going to be really little risk of other people connecting to your network without authorization, and then maybe explicitly identifying the SSID, something like I use the convention, attack N. So I'll have attack PSK, attack TKIP, attack WEP. And then, at least for me, it clearly identifies what the network is used for and hopefully will prevent other people from connecting to it. And if people connect to it anyway, they're violating on my network. And then, this is not a legal opinion, but I would say game on. So that's just my opinion of it.
Okay. For those of you who are listening, there's still more, and we'll go through them, but I wanted those of you who didn't get on right at the beginning, and now there are almost 1,000 people, so you might not know. This is Josh Wright, who is giving this briefing. It's an example of the types of things we do in SANS at Home, where you can take whole courses this way. Josh is the person who writes our wireless course, and you can get a sense for how deeply he understands it and how much fun he is to listen to. Let me give you a couple more questions. Are ARP frames the only traffic an attacker can decrypt?
No. Great question. No, an attacker can decrypt any traffic he wants to with the caveat of 1 byte per minute. So if an attacker could find a relatively inactive client, find a packet that he wanted to decrypt, he could spend, I would say, a good amount of time decrypting that packet. Now, what is practical, I think, is an attacker to select a packet and get at least a portion of the packet, say 20 bytes of the packet. Now, that 20 bytes might be all zeros and not useful, or it might be a bunch of data out of context. But at the same time, it could be an ASCII formatted credit card number, or it could be a password for a plain text authentication system, or potentially other sensitive information. So it really depends on how lucky the attacker gets, how much time he spends doing that, and the nature of the traffic going across your network.
Makes sense. You mentioned credit card data. Are there implications of this for retailers and people who are subject to PCI?
I really do, Alan. As part of the PCI specification, they recommend the use of WPA or WPA2, and certainly TCIF is involved there. There is no express requirement for retailers to move away from TCIF, and maybe that will change in the next version of the PCI specification like it did for WEP in this last iteration. I think that in my personal experience, most of the people using TCIF out there are consumers and the retail industry, simply because their amortization schedule on things like handheld scanners is usually on the order of 7 to 10 years, so they're usually dealing with much older technology. So as a result, I think that the retail industry is going to be particularly vulnerable to this attack.
Gotcha. Hey, you've given people an enormous amount. There's some more questions, but I think I will send them to you by email so that people can keep this to just about an hour, because I like to, when they're about an hour, people will come back and listen to them again or send other people to them. We will have this archived, I expect, by tomorrow. You also have Josh's website where he'll be posting slides and other supporting materials. So I hope this was useful to you. If you have other questions and you email them in, I'll forward them to Josh, and if he has time to do them, he'll get back to you with answers to them. But thank you, Josh Wright, for taking time to do this for everybody, and thank you to the people who are on the call. Signing off for now, this is Alan Paller, Director of Research for the SANS Institute.